The Tom Woods Show, episode 2148.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, delighted to welcome Joe Becker to the program from the Mises Institute. Joe has an interesting background because he got his master's degree in economics under Murray Rothbard at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He also had Hans Hoppe as a professor. So a very interesting background. He also worked for Ron Paul in various capacities. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And then I want to talk about a big, big, big deal going on at the Mises Institute. Something very, very important. Something I did not expect the Mises Institute to do, but that they have done. And that I know listeners of this show will want to know about if you don't know about it already. But it's a really, really great advance for all of us that they've done it. So I'll just leave it there. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
All right. You know, you and I have traveled in a lot of the same circles over the years, and we know a lot of the same people, and yet I barely know you. Like somehow, in all that travel, we never really met face-to-face until very recently when you came to the Mises Institute, or maybe very briefly. So you go back well beyond the Ron Paul presidential campaigns, because you actually had Murray Rothbard and Hans Hoppe as professors at UNLV. So we have to start our story there. Even though we want to talk about something very important the Mises Institute is doing, we have to start our story there. Now, first of all, did you know who these people were when you enrolled?
Well, actually, my time with Ron Paul goes back before that.
Oh, even before that?
Yeah,
okay.
Because what happened is a close friend of mine named Kent Snyder drugged me to a libertarian leadership conference, which was run by someone named Alicia Clark when I was living in Kansas City at the time. And Alicia Clark was the wife and I think like the national party chairman of the Libertarian Party in the 80s. And Kent and I arranged a three-day campaign trip for Ron Paul when he was running for president on the Libertarian ticket in 1988. So I got to know Ron a little bit then. In fact, I was... talk about coming full circle. I was recruiting students for a private school at the time, and I actually had Ron come and speak to that school in Kansas City. But one of the things Ron did is he gave me a copy of For a New Liberty by Rothbard. And I'd already had 21 hours of undergraduate econ, but never even heard of, well, Murray or the Austrian school, even for that matter. So I became interested, and then I signed up for my first Mises University in, I think it was 1989, after the Ron Paul campaign was over. So it was actually Ron that directed me to the Mises Institute in that very early going.
Can you just describe for the rest of us who are dying to know what it was like to have, for example, Murray Rothbard as your professor?
Well, it was great because I thought the world of his writing. And of course, I got a sense of who he was when I, because he was one of the instructors at, you know, Mises University in 89 when they went. I remember him and Hans and Lou Rockwell being there and Dr. David Gordon. I know he's been described as jolly and affable and happy libertarian. I found him to be that in every regard, always willing to help, always willing to give me time. You know, I sort of went to UNLV with the false impression that they would be so happy to have people like us coming to UNLV to study with them, that maybe it would be less than rigorous and we'd sort of be treated in a more friendly manner academically. But I definitely didn't find that to be the case. The study was rigorous. Hans and Murray were just as, or perhaps more demanding than the other instructors, but they were also much more enjoyable to be around. So.
Yeah. Now, they had a weird relationship with their department. And it was funny. Rothbard has this hilarious letter that he wrote in response to the department chairman, you know, evaluating his performance. And Rothbard had outperformed the rest of the department combined. So he wrote this blistering response. I hope I can find it somewhere. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you seen this thing?
I have some vague memory of it. I do know that, shall I call it tension, maybe more accurately division in the department, served me extremely well. How I got it, I don't know, but I wound up with a high GMAT score, which is what I used to get into school there. And that allowed me to have a graduate assistantship, but there weren't any graduate assistantships with the Austrians, to my knowledge. So I wound up working for sort of a lefty mathematical economist. I mean, he wouldn't describe himself as lefty, but I probably would. And they didn't talk to one another. But again, that served me super well, because what wound up happening is they would both talk to me, because one of them was my boss with the assistantship. And of course, I was there to work with Hans and Murray, so they were always happy to talk to me. So I would get the Austrian perspective on something and say, but how do you explain this to the lefty, you know, mathematician? And he would come up with some sort of an answer. So I would go back to the Austrians and say, but what about this? And so I had 2 years of basically being the conduit between the department professors who wouldn't talk to one another. And, you know, there was still tension even when I graduated and left and headed for law school, but it served me super well. Not only did I get to know Hans and Murray pretty well, but I got to understand Austrianism as contrasted with other schools of thought.
Well, my sense of it, not having been there, is that already you're going to have some tension because Hans and Murray are, quote unquote, not in the mainstream. But then combine that with the fact that, at least to the extent that this existed in the pre-internet age, they had a kind of academic star power. They actually had a following. Normal people actually wanted to read what they wrote. So now there are two reasons to hate them. One, because they're cranks, because they don't accept your crazy theories. But number two, envy, because they write things people actually read, and they're extremely prolific. I mean, they were as prolific, if not more, than the rest of the department combined. Anyway, I'm getting too much caught up, I think, in the politics of this.
No, I mean, I think it's true. And I think envy is, I mean, you probably listed them in the reverse order. It's probably envy
yeah,
more than,
right.
Because nobody, you know, and I wrote a little bit about this, nobody was flocking to UNLV to study with any of the other professors. And of course, I think Murray was congenial. Hans, on the other hand, could be a little more abrasive.
Abrasive?
Yeah, that's exactly the word I was about to say.
Yeah.
And of course, he had his own set of problems with the department just because.
Yeah, I know. Right. And plus, he was there after Murray died for a little while, so it was just him.
Yeah, I stayed in touch with him during that time because he was teaching the theory of time preference and was explaining how different groups had different time preferences relative to one another, and the university came after that on behalf of some member of some aggrieved group. And I was practicing law at the time, and our nonprofit litigation center was going to represent him, but we figured out that the ACLU had actually written the academic freedom policy for UNLV, and they volunteered to do it even more cheaply than we could, because we would have had travel involved from where I was living. So they took care of that. But yeah, it was never... This reminds me of a line from The Jerk with Steve Martin, but it was never easy for them, right? It was always something.
Yeah, it was never easy for me. I know the exact line you're talking about. So you had this amazing experience. You got to know these two people pretty well. Then I guess you did legal work with, well, you worked actually in Ron Paul's office, but I think you also worked on the presidential campaigns.
Yeah, that's true. I guess my other thank you goes out to Murray, because he wrote a really... obviously great writer, but served me selfishly well because he wrote me a really great letter of recommendation for law school. So I wound up doing that and doing almost all my law school classes to the extent I could. I catered him to law and economics classes. And then when I got out of law school, I had to take a regular job briefly. But actually what happened is Murray died while I was in law school. I went to Murray's memorial service in New York, and I ran into Ron, not surprisingly, for the first time since, you know, I worked with him on the 88 campaign. And he told me at the time, not everybody knows this, but I'm going to be running for Congress again in 96. And I said, well, I'll be getting out of law school about that time. If I could be of any help, you know, I would really like to help you out. And he said, well, it's a little bit of a long shot. We've got some elections to get through, and he wound up having a runoff election that time too. But when he did get elected, he got in touch with me and asked me to come and work with him, which was a natural fit because Murray was one of his intellectual heroes, of course. So there I went off to the hill, little kid who grew up in North Dakota. And, you know, Murray talked about DC a lot and how bad it was, but it turned out to be significantly worse than even Murray described it. I mean, working for Ron was great.
Yeah. Well, what made DC so bad?
Well, DC was just a bad place to be, and it's largely because of the people. First of all, the people who were drawn to it are political types, you know, not productive types. So generally unpleasant to be around. I think I was saying that, you know, Ron's office was staffed philosophically as opposed to geographically or politically. So it wasn't people whose parents had donated to the members' campaign. And it wasn't, you know, people particularly from the geographic district that the congressperson was from. It was philosophically staffed. So everybody in our office, they were great people and they were motivated and they wanted to do the right thing. On the other hand, most of the staffers in the other offices were not staffed that way. So, and you'd walk the halls and, you know, no one would look you in the eye. And it was the same thing on the metro, because I started out riding the metro to the office because it was easier than fighting DC traffic at the time, which is probably worse now. And I came away convinced that the reason no one would look you in the eye is because they all knew they were doing really bad things. And it's not like they knew who you were. That would probably have made it even worse. It's just kind of that they knew they were doing bad things. And so nobody really wanted to look anyone in the eye. And of course, they were always looking to see who might be more important if they were talking to you, looking over your shoulder. So just generally unpleasant people. Then, of course, the lobbyists, also people, but, you know, different motives. So we'd have an endless stream of lobbyists making appointments to come see us. And Ron would, of course, always see constituents from the district, but they weren't necessarily, you know, necessarily want to see every single lobbyist. So a lot of that got done by staff. I probably had the easiest office to work in as legislative director and then eventually deputy chief of staff because, you know, I was supposed to look at the bills and give Ron recommendations as to, or at least advise him as to what might be in there if he didn't happen to know. And it didn't take us very long. Didn't have to read very far into some piece of proposed legislation to figure out that there was no constitutional authority for it. And when a lobbyist would come to us and tell us, you know, they'd run through their short spiel about why we should support something. And I would always say, well, I had two little tricks. My first one was I was always say, well, that all sounds very interesting, which is a Washington word for there's no way we're going to do it, but it sounds interesting. I would always say that. And then I'd say, but you know, the first thing that Ron's going to ask me when I take this to him is where in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution is the federal government authorized to do this? And of course, you would just get these deer in the headlight expressions because they didn't really hear that from any other officer, certainly not too many more offices. But the other thing I did, which I found amusing, was there's this great quote. This was in the day when your screensaver, you remember this? It was a marquee that sort of scrolled some quote or something across.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So I found a great quote from Barbara Connable, who was a New York House member originally, and maybe even a senator eventually. And his quote was, "Hell hath no fury like a vested interest masquerading as a moral principle." So, you know, I'd be working on my computer. The lobbyists would come in, and then 2 or 3 minutes into their presentation, I had my computer screen strategically placed where they couldn't help but look at it. And then all of a sudden, this message would just start scrolling across the screen. So that was sort of my way of dealing with that. But my time with Ron was great. He was always, you know, I coming out of UNLV with Hans and Murray, I thought, well, I'm going to really be able to help Ron and instruct him on Austrian economics. This is great. And of course, it turns out he's probably one of the best macro guys I've ever met.
When you talk about Ron Paul, a lot of us say the same things. You know, he has this consistent record. He's courageous. He sticks to his principles. If it's not in the Constitution, he won't even consider it. And even if it is, he still doesn't usually want to do it in a lot of cases. And this is all great. And I don't disparage that in any way. This is all great. That's why I love him. But I want to know, are there any little stories that only you know about or things that particular memories of being in that office that stand out to you? Like, maybe it was 9/11, maybe it was something else, but was there something about being in that office, any particular stories that that illustrate the man, who he was, to us?
Well, I do remember 9/11 pretty well. I was there at the time. You know, I went into work like a normal day. And of course, I was on the East Coast. So I was probably in my office at 7:30, which was before, I think before the first plane struck the first tower. But the phone rang and it was Ron. And he said, we probably had the TV on C-SPAN because that's what we did. And he said, are you watching TV? And I said, well, I've got C-SPAN on. And he said, no, you need to watch, I don't know if you said Fox or something, some other channel. So we switched it over. And he said, nobody realizes how big this is yet, but this is a really big thing. Which, of course, was smarter than the average bear, obviously. So he knew that. The other thing I remember about 9/11 was trying to get him home. Because you remember, all the planes were grounded for a really long time. And he had just come to D.C. In fact, he'd come up the weekend before, I think, because I turned in my end of the session notice. I was going to quit working for him at the end of that year. I'd been there almost five. And initially, he said he maybe would stay 2 years or 4 years at the most. So I felt like I'd done my Christian duty. But Ron really wanted to be with his family. I mean, that was the thing. And I finally found him a Southwest flight flying out of Baltimore because everything was canceled, full, whatever. I guess the other thing I probably know that most people don't know is how badly he really wanted to get home to Texas and, more importantly, to his family during that time. So I guess those are the two things that come to mind, especially when you say 9/11.
Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Hey folks, I don't know if you've ever experienced burnout, but I am the poster child for burnout. As I've said over and over again, for those 2 years that I worked on the Ron Paul curriculum, I was just stretched to the limit. It was nonstop work because I was also doing the Tom Woods Show and also traveling around the world giving lectures and doing all these sorts of things. And plus, I'm a dad and I have lots of responsibilities, but I'd bought into this crazy modern idea that if I had any free moments, like the 10 minutes I'm waiting for an oil change or the 20 minutes I'm waiting in line at the post office, that all that time has to be filled by work. No time for reflection, relaxation, doing something pleasurable, whatever. But work is not the only cause of burnout. Any of our roles in life can lead us to feel burned out. And you can feel like you have a lack of motivation. You can feel irritable, fatigued. Well, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talking with someone can help you figure out what's causing stress in your life. And by the way, I'm very happy to tell you that I myself have used BetterHelp in the past, and it did wonders for me. I was matched with somebody who understood my situation exactly and helped me get back on track. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/woods. That's better, HELP.com/woods. Let's fast forward to today. For the past several years, you've been working on and then have since completed and begun a master's program in economics at the Mises Institute that people can enroll in remotely. So I'd like to know about it. First of all, is it quote unquote accredited? So if somebody gets this, is it considered a degree? Is it a certificate of completion? Does it count for anything? Fill us in on those details, then we'll get into what it's all about.
Well, I would say it counts for a lot because of what it is. A school has to be in operation for a certain period of time before they can even apply for accreditation. We got a license, a private school license from the state of Alabama to operate a master's degree program in Austrian economics. That allows us to teach our program to Alabamans and to people in half the other states around the country. We designed the program with accreditation in mind. It's certainly our goal. By getting accreditation, we don't have to get licensed in every single state or monitor the regulatory scheme in every state because there's a reciprocity organization we can join. So I can't go into a lot of the details about our process because we don't want to lead people to believe that we're almost accredited or even guarantee them that we will be, but I can assure you the program was designed with accreditation in mind. Most schools take about 5 years from inception to getting accreditation awarded. I can only say our goal is to make sure that happens. But you know, that's normal for any startup school. It's valuable, though, as I initially said, because it's purely Austrian. You know, some might say I had a great opportunity, which I did, to go to UNLV, but even there I had to take quantitative, micro, and macro with non-Austrians. Almost everything else I was able to do with Hans and Murray. But this one, every single class, all 30 hours are taught only by Austrians. And of course, the Mises Institute set itself up very well to do this because for almost, well, for 40 years now, I guess I can say, they've been helping graduate students get through their PhD programs. So we have this vast expert faculty in the Austrian school. And of course, the beauty of the online program is if you want to take monetary with a monetary expert, you don't have to move to New Jersey. And then if you want to do regulatory cronyism stuff, you don't have to move to, you know, wherever Tom DiLorenzo or Patrick Newman are. I mean, you get to do everything with the best subject matter experts in the Austrian school right from wherever you happen to be, assuming you're in a state where we can currently teach. So there's that. Another big advantage is that we have a lot of private donors who are very excited about this program. So our tuition is about 1/3 of what one would typically pay for another online or even traditional education program.
So how long has it been open and running? Is it a couple of years, a year?
It is. I came in fall of 19. We started our first cohort in August of 20. I'm proud to say that our first few graduates will be going through commencement next month at the end of July. We've started 4 cohorts of graduate students. They're all, well, you can't say they're all progressing well. I mean, it is a time commitment. It's not, I guess, hearkening back to my earlier comments about Murray, it's rigorous. We're not just handing out degrees. We want people to know when we put our brand name on someone, we want them to know what they should know. So we lose a couple students, but for the most part, people are hanging in there. It's 15 to 19 hours of work every week to do what has to be done. I mean, the program is taught asynchronously, so they can kind of do things on their own schedule, but there is a requirement that they meet their weekly deadlines and turn in the work every week. So, I mean, that's kind of how it works. We have live office hours, we have lectures, we have discussion board posts. I mean, pretty standard online stuff, except it's purely Austrian, which is unique. And of course, this was a goal of Murray and von Mises back in the 40s when they were trying to get this thing going somewhere else. So a couple attempts to do it, it didn't happen, but here we are.
Well, it's something people have wanted for a long time, is to be able to do this. And especially now, I noticed the change in the Mises University program for undergraduates, the in-person program for undergraduates, from the time I attended in 1993 to when I started teaching at it. And the difference was that because of the internet, the kids were showing up at a much, much higher level, with a much higher level of knowledge, previously existing knowledge already, because they had had access, easy access to all these materials. I had to dig through in some academic library to find some of these obscure articles. Well, not anymore. And so you got kids who, they've already read half the stuff we're talking about. So now you have an audience that has had the opportunity to be exposed to Austrian economics to the extent that now they're ready for a master's program. Now they want some advanced material, and we have the opportunity to give it to them. Now, the typical master's program at a university involves a master's thesis at the end. Are you also requiring that to get the degree, and how does that work?
Yeah, we do require that. The way it works is, while they're taking their core courses and then their electives, they will normally identify a topic. We encourage them to start thinking about it, you know, as soon as they finish their core courses. They probably have been exposed to a variety of professors at that point. So we basically ask students, what would you like to write on? And with whom would you like to work? And we try and accommodate their requests as best as we can. And like I say, we don't have a shortage of PhDs in good economics. You know, we have plenty of those at our disposal. So they will go to work. They have 2 8-week terms or longer if necessary to write their thesis. I mean, the mission of the school is to provide quality online education, prepare faculty, and promote research in the Austrian School of Economics. I mean, that's the official mission statement. And so the thesis makes perfect sense because we want them to produce an article that's suitable for publication in a peer-reviewed journal as a condition of graduating. So that is a requirement. And of course, I was 5 years ahead of you, at least chronologically, at my first Mises U. And I think I went there with nothing more than Foreign New Liberty by Murray Rothbard. So your point's very well taken on the what students are coming to us with as opposed to what you or I went to Mises University with back in the day.
Well, I want to link, I'll find what the page is, but of course I'll link on the show notes page to where people can read about the master's program and indeed even enroll. So that'll be at tomwoods.com/2148. Can you just run down some of the names of the academics at the Mises Institute whose materials you would indeed be studying as a master's student in this program?
Yeah, you know, I have a book list. I didn't bring it, but obviously the program concentrates heavily on the work of von Mises and Rothbard. We use the structure of production. We use Dr. Salerno's monetary materials. We use a lot of journal articles that have been published over the years. We do have a mathematical quantitative econ course, but it's taught from an Austrian perspective, which is really important. It emphasizes not only descriptive statistics, which we find useful, but the limitations of quantitative in the Austrian school. So that's very good. Just to make it easy for you, and it's pretty easy for people to remember, Mises.org/edu is actually the page that you can go to. It's just Mises.org/edu.
Oh, okay. So that is easy.
Yeah. So okay. You can find everything there. You can find the catalog. You can find the online application. We'll start another cohort here in August, which I guess is about 2 months off. We still have a couple of places there if someone is interested. And probably worthwhile to mention what we're looking for in students.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have to have an undergraduate degree already?
Yes. That is a requirement for a master's degree program that is seeking accreditation.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never heard of one that doesn't. So I guess that would have to be a requirement.
Yeah, that is a requirement. So we would want that. We'd want them to have ample undergraduate or graduate coursework in economics. And we don't expect people to know Austrianism because that's what we teach. And so many people go through their undergraduate courses with micro and macro, maybe intermediate micro and macro. But we do need people to be conversant in principles, concepts, and terminology of economics that they would typically get as an undergraduate. We like to know that people are interested in this particular school of thought because that's what we teach. And we'd like them to have clearly defined goals as to what they plan to do with the knowledge. I mean, we're not really looking for hobbyists or dabblers because the donors are paying a big portion of the student's tuition and we don't charge for books. It's all included. So we want students who have an idea of why they want to learn this and what they plan to do with it when they finish. And we're really preparing people to teach at the undergraduate or community college level. We're preparing people for policy work. I'm thinking about some of the people who we have in the program that are doing real well, entrepreneurs, financial planners, maybe estate planning attorneys, which kind of goes with finance. And then we have some people who want to do public interest litigation like what I did. And I will say I found my time with Murray and Hans most useful when I went to law school and practiced constitutional law for 20 years than I did.
Well, I think it's tremendous what you're doing because, of course, there's nothing wrong with teaching, you know, younger students or having material available for adult enrichment, but actually to be able to get a degree at the end and to go through the process of writing a master's thesis, potentially getting it published. I don't think we have that anywhere in our movement, certainly. And in academia, even, it's hard to find a pure Austrian program. So this is a great new direction for the Mises Institute. And it's an addition, I shouldn't say it that way. It's an additional direction for the Mises Institute.
Yeah, it's a new project about which we're very excited. And I'm very happy to be a part of. I mean, I feel like, you know, I got as close to this as I could with what there was at the time, but I think this is definitely better.
Well, I would think that the audience of the Tom Woods Show is about as perfect a target demographic for this master's program as you are likely to find anywhere on this earth. So for folks who are interested, it's Mises, M-I-S-E-S, Mises.org/edu. I'll also be linking to it at tomwoods.com/2148. Well, good luck with it, Joe. I hope it continues to grow and flourish.
Yes, we expect only good things going forward. And it's always, well, it's nice getting to know you a little bit better other than just crossing in the hallways here over the last couple of years.
So. And taking over my old office at the Mises Institute.
That's right. It's a fine one, except when they're blowing the leaves and the pine straw out from, as you probably remember, from behind.
I have so many fond memories of that office. And then wasting time by, you know, procrastinating, going over to talk to Mark Thornton in the next office.
Yep.
Who was so understanding when I would go do that.
Yeah, he's still there.
Yeah.
So I have the same temptation, but.
Well, I am looking forward. I assume you're going to be in Arizona in October. Can I assume that?
I certainly will.
Okay. So in October, the Mises Institute is having its 40th anniversary celebration as part of its supporter summit this year. It takes the form of a 40th anniversary celebration. So I'll be one of the speakers, and it's a real star-studded lineup. It's very, very much worth checking out. So that's Mises.org/events. You want to be there. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And thanks for the conversation today.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, just a reminder, the number of episodes, as I said, will sort of dwindle a bit this month, a few here and there each week rather than the consistent five. But we'll be getting back to the full schedule within a week or two, be back to the robust Tom Woods Show schedule. In the meantime, you have 2,147 old episodes that you can always listen to keep you company. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.